Okay. Now, for the third and final time, we're going to attempt to interview Bobby Galloway. Bob, if you will, once again, for our listeners, we'll go, your place of birth is Grays
South,
County.
South Grays County in the Sedalia community. I've been there all my life, 30 years. I was born in August of 1953. We operate a general farming operation there, about 175 to 200 acres of row crop. We also have approximately 32 acres of tobacco. I'm in this operation with an older brother. I also teach school at Sedalia High School and a vocational agriculture teacher.
And how long have you taught school?
I've taught school for 8 years.
Okay, now let's try to go back a little bit. And I don't remember too much what you told me anyway, because I was concerned about the tape last time, so if you want to go into a lot of detail, that's fine. But your earliest recollections of farming, now your father was a farmer?
My father was a farmer. We had a rather small to medium-sized dairy operation for the period of time since I've been born. We milked approximately 40 grade dairy animals. We sold grade B and C milk for manufacturing purposes until the early 60s, late 50s, 1959 to be exact, we got into the grade A dairy business. But we started out with milk cows. We grew our feedstuffs, corn, and oats, wheat. Soybeans at that time were unheard of in the community or in this part of the country. It was pretty much subsistence farming, with the dairy being our major source of income, some tobacco also.
What is grade B and grade C milk versus grade A? What's the difference?
Okay, it's referred to as manufactured milk. It doesn't go into, it's not the grade A milk that you would buy in a grocery store to drink. Manufactured milk would go into, be sold for manufacturing purposes. The bacterial count in it, as far as microorganisms, can be higher. It doesn't have to be hardly as clean. The surroundings that it's produced in do not have to be hardly as up-to-date and as modern facilities. Pet milk at that time in the 50s operated a manufactured milk plant in Mayfield, Kentucky, and a lot of the local farmers produced milk and sold it there. This milk is canned milk. It also goes into processing of cheeses, processing of other foods. Of course, a lot of foods have milk in them and milk solids in them, and that's where this milk was going.
Okay, and during this time period, you were, when you were working on the farm, when you first started getting out and doing chores, you were 8 or 10 years old, something like that?
Well, we started a little earlier than that, about 5 and 6. We had chores for as long as I can remember, but we actually done the milking. Whenever I started school, I was actually involved in the milking. At 6 years old.
And so that was milking by hand?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see now, did your grandfather farm too? How far back does your land go?
Okay, I'm approximately the fourth generation on the farm. My great-grandfather came in here from Trigg County, Kentucky, with the purchase, I suppose, of the Jackson Purchase, and it was before the Civil War, because I remember my parents talking of slaves that he brought into this community, him and his brothers and the Wilford family. They took over large tracts of land between Sedalia and Farmington and farmed it and used slave labor. At this time, we are still farming a small portion of some of those holdings that they took over.
Approximately how many acres do you still have as part of the original tract?
As part of the original tract, we have approximately 60 acres of it, with about 45 of it's total. The rest of it's in woods and cut up by creeks, and it's not productive one.
Okay, so you were a young man working on the farm and just a kid working on the farm, yeah. Doing chores. And if you could, to kind of recap a few things for our listeners, describe for me, say like in you're in elementary school, a typical day. We'll just kind of take it that way. And then,
all right. Typical day, if when, of course, when we weren't going to school, We always got up early, about 5 o'clock, sometimes 4:30 if we were in school. Of course, they'd catch a bus in to go to school. But around 5 o'clock during the summer months, daylight, we'd start milking. One of my chores was to get the cows up. Of course, they'd be out in the pasture.
And this is 40 cows?
Yes. I'd have to get up and, of course, get out a little bit earlier than the rest of them. But that was my job, go out and get the cows up, get them in the barn, and get them in a pen, holding pen there, ready to be milked. Then, of course, we all had chores. We helped with the milking. Calves had to be fed. Chickens had to be fed. Hogs had to be fed. We had all kinds of livestock. You know, we had a few hogs that we sold. Most of the hogs, you know, are we used them for home use. We sold a few to neighbors, and a few went to market. Not really. Mother was sort of in charge of the chickens. Those were her chickens, and we had chicken for dinner every Sunday, of course. But we also sold a few and sold some eggs a lot too. But pretty much subsistent-wise, as far as chickens and hogs were concerned. But still, all the animals had to be fed. Mules and horses had to be fed. Then around 7 o'clock, all of our chores, as far as the feeding and milking, was done. We'd eat a big breakfast. Then we'd go to fields. It might be to work in tobacco. It might be working corn or fencing, whatever, you know, whatever needed to be done that day. And we'd stay all day, probably to around 4 o'clock. At 4 o'clock come, we'd start off, and that was time to come in and milk, you know. Cows had to be milked, the chickens had to be fed again, the hogs had to be fed. We took head count to make sure, you know, you didn't have an animal sick down in the field somewhere, or if you had a cow trying to calve, you had to keep up with all that. And everybody had their own responsibilities. Of course, like I said, there was 8 of us, counting my mother and father, 6 children and my parents, and we all, everybody shared in the responsibility.
A lot of work to be done,
sounds like. We got on milking usually around 6:30. We went in, had a big supper, and went to bed early, because we knew we'd have to get up and do the same thing the next day.
Now, how many brothers and sisters did you have helping out with all this?
Our family was sort of split. There's 18 years difference between my oldest brother and myself. I have one brother a year younger than me, and another one 4 years older. So there were 3 older children, and they were in high school and college at this time, and 3 of us younger ones that were at home and in elementary school.
So there's quite a split there.
Quite a split, yeah. The heavier chores, if there's tractor driving and things like that to be done, hay to be put up, the older ones done that. Of course, my sister worked in the house with mother, and we canned and froze all of her food, and had pretty much, we didn't have a big grocery bill. Mother and we had big gardens, and of course, like I alluded to a while ago, we raised our own livestock for beef and pork and eggs and chicken and things like this.
Now, all crops was basically subsistence. It just all came back to the farm.
It went right back into the feed on the farm. Good years, we'd have a little corn, maybe some wheat or oats to sell.
Right.
We also raised tobacco as a cash crop.
Now that was all done by hand, no plows, gas, you know, tractors, things like that.
Okay, now by the time I guess I was in the second, third grade, we had a tractor. We had some tractors. Now, I can remember when I was younger, before I was involved in that, when we used all mule labor, you know, our animals.
So you saw your dad driving a team?
Right, and even after I got involved in it, after I was 6 or 7 years old, on up to about the time I was 10, you know, he was one that believed that tobacco had to be worked with a mule. And we worked tobacco crops with a mule team. Plowed tobacco, hard tobacco with it. We kept mules until probably 1963, 64. Up to about the time I was 10 years old, we kept a team of mules there and used them all the time.
Huh. When did your dad first, he got a tractor, you said, when you were 6 or 7. How did he kind of react to that? I guess he was glad to see the...
He was tickled to death. He traded an old car, I think a T-Model Ford or something that he had there for a long time, in on a tractor for $300. And that was a lot of money back then. He bought a tractor, and people around him thought he was crazy. They didn't think that a tractor would do in this part of the country. It just was unheard of, almost.
Now, why is that? Because the way the land flows?
The way the land
flows,
was, tractors were new at that time, you know.
Newfangled.
Yeah, it's something new. You know, you couldn't take a tractor and beat a plow on a team, you know. And we actually had farmers' community that would race to see who could do the most. Dad with a tractor, or some of the other farmers with a team. And they'd stand, you know, like a bunch of crows on a fence row. They'd stand around and watch and see what it done that first year. The second year, we had another neighbor or two that bought them, and eventually it caught on pretty good.
So your dad had the first tractor in the area, is that
yes.
safe to say?
Yeah.
Okay, and...
Other than steam tractor, he had the first gasoline-powered tractor.
Okay.
We know tractors today.
All right, when did you start getting into the mentality that you wanted to be a farmer or an ag teacher? Where did you start changing there somewhere?
Well, I never did really ask myself a question. It's just something I brought up today, I guess.
To farm?
To farm and to teach ag both.
Well, surely somewhere you said, I want to teach ag. Did you have a teacher influence you in high school or something?
Yeah, I had a lot of good teachers. I never did. I don't guess I ever had a bad teacher.
I wish I could say.
Teachers were something that were always reverend to me. They were almost like gods. They stayed at school all the time. They didn't have any family problems or anything like that, you know. I looked upon teachers as respect. My parents, that was their goal in life, was to put us boys through college and for us to teach and to farm.
Did your parents have college education?
No, they both had high school diplomas, but no college whatsoever. And we were just brought up, and it was instilled in us, I suppose, at an age so young that we never really asked a question as to what we were going to do. At one time here in Graves County with six high schools, myself and two other brothers taught vocational agriculture in three of the six high schools. It was just something.
So you had a good corner on the education here.
Yeah, we had a corner on the ag market in Graves County.
Now, did all your brothers went to college and they all got degrees in ag? Is that?
Attended college. I had one brother that was killed at age 20 as a sophomore in a car accident in 1960. I had another brother that was drafted into the service at about that time, and of course during the Bay of Pigs ordeal and all, got called up and had to serve in the service, and when he came back, he never did return to college. But I think he was a junior when this happened. So everybody made a start. And my sister ended up in home economics, a teacher of home economics. And the three younger boys did finish college and went on to teach.
Okay, and now your other brothers, are they teaching still? Or?
I have one brother that is that taught for a couple of years. He's currently a U.S. tobacco grader. In the U.S. tobacco grading market. He travels all over the country and he grades tobacco for the federal government. I have another brother that is director of pupil personnel here in Graves County in the school system.
Okay, now, last time I talked to you, didn't you mention to me that when you were in high school you had some kind of project going on? Maybe it wasn't you, I was trying to think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What the deal? We were brought up, of course.
Could you hold that mic a little closer?
Yeah, and 4-H. And
you can just stick it on your lapel if you want to.
Okay.
But it's up to you.
We were brought up in 4-H and
that's
FFA.
Correct.
In elementary school, of course, we were members of the 4-H Club through the County Extension Service, and then in high school, we started into FFA through Vocational Agriculture and FFA program.
Now, did you take, when you were in 4-H, did you take... Like the impression I always have, because I was a city kid, you know, 4-H kids, take a calf to the fair, and did you do all that?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And
we
hogs?
Showed
and
cattle, showed some hogs and cattle. We learned a lot about electricity. I can remember making lamps and things like this, but we had projects in dairy cattle and hogs and learned how to show and fit cattle. Learn how to show and feed hogs and grow crops too, gardens and things like this. And then as we progressed into high school, of course, it went into some enterprise productive enterprise products such as dairy, tobacco, and things like this. What we done was each student was required to establish himself a farming program or an experience program. Of course, vocational agriculture trains for gainful employment in that area, so you are required to have a project or an experience program, a program that will get you some experience in that area. Well, I was fortunate enough, coming from a farm, that we had a dairy. We were growing and raising our own livestock, our own cows. And I started out with some cattle in elementary school, showing them. And by the time I finished high school, I had enough cattle that we sold out of the dairy business my freshman year in college. And when I sold my cows, I had enough put me through a couple of years of college.
So you paid for school just with your...
Right, I paid for my college education, or 2 years of it, just from the from cattle. Of course, up until that time, I paid for a lot of things, clothes and books and things like this in high school, and a lot of gasoline things through the monthly milk check that we were getting from returns from the cattle. Daddy had cattle, and all the boys had some too. They give us an opportunity. There's very few times that I ever went to Daddy and said, I need $5 tonight to go to town. He gave us an opportunity to have our own money, but if we didn't get out and work for it, we usually sit at home.
Now,
things is, is swim or sink. And he gave us opportunity, He could have had those cattle and had the returns come back and got a lot of pressure off him, I'm sure. But instead, he was willing to give up part of his farming operation and give it to us. Of course, you write a lot of those things off, I guess, to the cost of raising a boy or whatever.
Well, I guess teaching responsibility and...
Right.
During this time period, let's say the interim, getting ready for college, when you're in high school, how much of the tobacco crop and the corn crop and stuff did the income of the family depend on? Did you still, the bulk of the money was made through the dairy industry?
Right. Everything was designed around the dairy industry. Of course, that check was coming in twice a month. We'd get a milk check twice a month. Most of the row crop at that time was corn and wheat. That was grown specifically for cattle feed and silage. We grew a lot of hay. Of course, put up lots of hay every year, 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 bales annually for feed, most of our land for that. At that time, in this part of the country, there was a government program called the Feed Grain Program. And some farmers signed up lands in the feed grain and had idled that land for 10 years. They received subsistence payments to idle the land. We would rent some of that land for pasture, and it was seeded down to sod pasture. Yeah. We would rent some of that land in the fall of the year and cut hay off of it, or pasture off of it, for our livestock. And then, of course, we were able to carry a few more cows than we would normally with no more land than we own.
Now, was this land put in this idle program just to restore the land?
Right.
Or just to reduce the amount of crops, or what?
For both purposes. Conservation practices had to be used in order to qualify for it. You had to seed it down where it couldn't wash away. But the primary reason was to get it out of production. Farmers were growing too much. So they come up with a program. It lasted 10 years to keep farmers from farming, actually.
I guess that land was in better shape, too, after that 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
If you'd have got that right after that 10-year period, you probably had some pretty good crops.
Right. It really paid off in the long run. And at that time, the payments were good enough that some farmers bought some land through this program, signed it up, and the returns that the government gave them was enough to make the payments on it.
Really?
It worked out kind of funny. Land prices were cheap at that time, and you could almost pay for land with just the government subsidy payment, feed grain payment.
Okay, so during this time period now, how many acres did your family work?
About 175.
Okay. So now let's get you up and to the point where you go to college. You went to Murray State?
Went to Murray State. I commuted the first 2 years. This brother that went in the service came back and bought a small grocery store in the community over here. Since we got out of the dairy business and was involved in the row crop, I was able to help him some in a grocery store for a little extra cash for the first 2 years I was in school. The three younger boys that were still at home and still in college, we rented the land from my father and grew row crops on it. We didn't grow any tobacco. Tobacco was too intense. It required too much labor. And of course, going to school too, but we did grow corn and soybeans on it for 4 or 5 years there. And that helped us. We got 2/3 of the returns, and my father got 1/3. Which was as good a deal as he could get from any surrounding farmers, and it helped us out too. Of course, I worked part-time at the grocery store and got back. I got married while I was in college, and I took a job at a factory.
So did you take like a full load each semester at school? So you had two or three major things going each semester, it seems like.
Yeah, we farmed. I farmed with my brothers. I worked at a tire factory. 40 to 60 hours a week. I was a lab technician there. Went to school full time. I didn't get a lot of sleep, but I got to get on. You know, you just do those kind of things sometimes. And I wouldn't do it again. If I look back, I wouldn't do it again.
Okay.
I thought I had to at that time.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to do it anyway. Now, you graduated from college.
I graduated from college. I was...
In 70?
75.
75.
In the fall of 75, and it took me 4.5 years to get out since I did work.
Did you take strictly agricultural classes, or you got a teaching degree somewhere in there, or what?
I got a teaching certificate. I had to take some humanities courses, communication courses, and all, of course, to qualify for certification for teaching.
Right.
And I went back then and got my teaching certificate, done one semester of work in student teaching and education courses in order to get my teaching certificate. Of course, in the middle 70s, it was a lot different than it is today. Today, you have to declare that you're going to teach by your sophomore year or you're in trouble. You know, there's so many government standards. At that time, you could go through, get a BS degree, and go back one semester and complete the requirements pretty much for teaching.
Okay, now your extent of education then is in a bachelor's degree?
I have a master's degree, and I have about 10 hours above a master's.
Oh, okay.
I have a master's degree in agriculture, and then a 10 hours above a master in secondary administration of high school administration.
Okay, so...
I'm still going to school.
All right.
I'm 30 years old and still going to school, yes.
Where?
At Murray State. I take night courses. I go to school one or two nights a semester. But the pay scale in education is such that you nearly have to.
But you've already got your master's, right?
Oh, yes.
So why keep going?
Okay, the pay scale in education in the state of Kentucky is such that there's about $4,000 a year difference between a regular bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And then about that much difference between a master's degree and 30 hours above a master's degree.
Oh, so you're working on your 30 above.
On my 30 above.
Oh, okay.
And at this point, I'm going in the direction of administration. I'm probably never use it. If I'm going to teach and stay in education, I want to be in the classroom with students. But at the same time, there's these things of teacher burnout and all. They don't have anything to offer that'll improve my teaching, I don't think, in agriculture. I went through and got a master's in ag, so I'm getting in administration. If I get burned out in teaching in the classroom, as some people tell me I'm going to in a few years, I may look at administration, principal or something like that. But right now I'm doing what I want to do.
Right. Well, you're preparing yourself, too,
right.
So that's always good to do. Okay, so... Let's see, you've gone to college and you get your degree and you immediately get a teaching job here at Sedalia High?
No, I was lucky. When I went through, a professor at Murray State told me, he said, Bobby, you're crazy. said, you'll never get a job in West Kentucky teaching agriculture. And at that time, I think we had 8 or 9 agriculture teachers in Graves County, and they were all relatively young. But we had some changes in administration. We had some teachers moving in and out into other areas. Agriculture was booming, of course, in the mid-70s. Some went with PCAs and banks and things like this, and ag industry. Others went into administration within the education system. So I had a couple of holes that opened up, and I was fortunate enough to be hired and went to teaching at Lowe's, which is in the north end of Graves County. Taught there 2 years. And the changes kept occurring, and I got an opportunity. The boy that was teaching here took a job in ag industry, and I got a chance to come home, and so I did. They offered me an opportunity to come back here and teach, and it was 4 miles from home, you know, I couldn't turn it down.
So you couldn't beat that.
Right.
And so then you've been here 6 years?
6 years, right.
And you seem like you're pretty content.
Yeah, I'm doing exactly what I want to do. What I've always wanted to do.
And you don't want to leave West Kentucky? You're pretty well...
I want to stay where I am. I moved one time in my life, and I moved across the road. I'm still living on the same farm that I was born on, farming the same...
You moved across the street?
Moved across the road, and that's it. When I got married, I put what few clothes I had on my back, on the hangers, and throw those hangers across my back and walked across there. I put up a house trailer over there. And since that time, I've built a new home, and I'm going to stay.
So how long have you been married? Let's bring your wife in this a little bit.
Okay, well, I've been married 11 years in November.
And your wife's name is?
Donna. And she works at a bank in Mayfield.
Okay, now does she do any bookkeeping for your farm projects or
she
anything?
She does nearly all of it. I kid her a lot of times. She's the best hand I've got. And it's a tobacco operation. We ran through last year, in the last 12-month period, I paid FICA wages, and my total labor bill was $14,000, just on labor alone. And she does all the bookwork. She works in the field too. You know, that was one thing when we got married. We decided that if we were going to get in this tobacco business, and she's going to farm. She's a city girl. She grew up in the city. That she was going to be in there with me, and she. She
took to it pretty well?
Yeah, she didn't mind it at all.
Huh.
Since I've got a 4-year-old son and another one expected in June, and she, of course that sort of limits her. But she enjoys it. You know, she works in the bank all day, just like I'm in the classroom, and that's an out for her too. Come in on an afternoon and put her blue jeans on and get out in the field.
Now, is she like a bookkeeper or?
She's a branch secretary now. She started out in bookkeeping and then as a teller and has moved up, and she's secretary of the branch there for the bank now.
Okay, tell me about the farming is like a two-edged sword. There's a lot of things that kind of cut both ways. You know, you've got the advantage of you're your own boss as far as your time, but then when there's something to be done, you're a slave to that operation as far as, you know, you just got to get it done, and,
right.
And you got to work till it is done. Talk to me about the advantages and the disadvantages of farming.
Well, of course, that's why they make chocolate and vanilla, I guess. There's all kinds of advantages and disadvantages, too. I look back and when I was in high school, and I, of course, see high school students every day, I didn't play basketball. Every afternoon, when school was out, I went home. I had chores to do and cows to milk or whatever. I never did have a date on Sunday afternoon. You know, a lot of kids on Sunday afternoon get in the car and go to a movie or go to the lake and ski or whatever. I knew that at 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, I'd better be home to milk. Those were disadvantages, but at the same time, I'd done about anything else I wanted to do. And farming offered me a source of income, a source of pride, and I suppose that source of pride, more than anything else, is why I enjoy it. There's nothing that does me any more good than somebody come to me and say, hey, you've got a good-looking crop, or you've done good, you know, and it's a constant challenge from 1 year to the next. It's a business of where you're trying to make a living. But at the same time, it's very competitive. I feel like to produce a unit of corn or a unit of tobacco or a pound of pork cheaper, more economical with less labor than my neighbor. You know, farmers compete against each other too. And that's something that you don't get in industry. You go to a tire plant or you go to a car manufacturing plant, you're not trying to outproduce your neighbor. The company may be, but you as a paid employee aren't. Whereas in farming, you're competing against everybody. Everybody that's in the tobacco business or the dairy business, everybody's trying to do more than their neighbor at a cheaper cost. You're your own boss. It's got some disadvantages. Right now, 1984, farming doesn't look good. You know, we've come through this thing of embargoes, of using food as a weapon. We've got some high interest rates. The barrier to enter into farming right now is some $500,000 just to get into it. But at the same time, you're your own boss. It's a challenge every day. You get up every morning and work for yourself. It's not a thing that you don't have to listen to other people. Because when you got to be a fairly sharp individual to go to a bank, borrow $100,000 of somebody else's money, and go out here and sock it in the ground. Those people are betting on you. And not just anybody can do that anymore. At the same time, you know, I look around and I see guys that are 47 years old, 50 years old, that have lost everything they work for. And that's old to start all over again. But I don't think you can beat it. I'd rather get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go out and do something for myself than I had to get up and go in at 8 o'clock and do something for somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, I don't get to see, I never got to see the tires go out the back door onto those automobiles. I didn't derive a lot of pleasure from that. But I can derive a lot of pleasure at seeing those crops grow and seeing something that I've actually done.
Now, do you do all your mechanical work and maintenance and all the upkeep on the farm? And do you do most of that?
A large percentage of it, I try to do myself. You've got to be a mechanic, a diesel mechanic, and a fairly good electrician. Used to, you know, a farmer didn't worry about mechanics as long as he changed the points on his plow and feed his mules right, well, he was okay. He could go wherever he was. Today, you've got to be a diesel mechanic and a hydraulic specialist. You've got to know fuels and lubricants from the top to bottom. You've got to have enough physics to know a little bit about gears and pulleys and how these work. You can't find just anybody to tear down and work on, or I wouldn't want anybody to work on a $90,000 combine.
Yes, that's a good point.
You don't take that down to the local service station and let them work on it. You know. You've got to know pretty much how to adjust that machine in the field yourself. If you're combining corn and you've got 3 bushels of seed going out the back of that machine per acre, that could be the only profit that you have. So you've got to be able to adjust that machinery yourself. If you've got a plow that's pulling an extra gallon of fuel per hour through that tractor because it's not set right, you better be willing to get off and set it yourself. Because if you have to wait and get a mechanic out there or somebody out there to set your machinery for you, you waste time and it costs you money. Now those guys get $30 an hour for shop labor. They start charging you from the time they leave their shop and come to the field. They charge you $30 an hour for travel time too, plus parts and everything else. You got to be a chemist. You're mixing chemicals daily. You got to know what chemicals will go with something else. You got to be a vet. Our grandparents and even my parents very seldom they'd give animal shots. We shoot them up with antibiotics and growth stimulators and things, hormones and things like this daily. Those are things that we use as edges for production. To produce more at a lower cost. You got to be an accountant, bookkeeper. The farmer's never getting rich, but you better keep up with it or Uncle Sam will claim that you are. for tax purposes, other decision-making policies on the farm. It's a business. You got to be a businessman. You got to be a market analyst. If they don't get a rain in Iowa today, corn will go up, and you've got to know that. That's why that two-way radio and that AM/FM radio was sitting in that tractor, along with the two-way. If beans are up to 20 cents a bushel today, you better get on the radio and call into your wife and have her contract you some forward contract or hedge you some crops, or else get a hold of your broker and get them hedged. You know, it's a big business. And if you can turn a dime bushel more profit today by making a decision than you could yesterday or tomorrow, then you've got to make that decision. And you've got to have a vast amount of resources of information available to you constantly. And it's ever-changing.
Seems like you got to be a pretty optimistic sort of fella, too. I mean, you live on faith anyway, but a farmer seems like he's banking on a lot of things that may or may not happen, like the market, and after the summer of 83, you know, you don't have any guarantees about the weather, that's for sure.
A farmer can lose more in 1 year than an average man will make back in 10. I can lose enough money in my small farming operation. I can lose so much money that it would take me 10 years, 10 good years in a row to make it back.
Is that why partially that you teach? I mean, is that kind of a buffer against just totally, if something really happens where you get wiped out?
That's one thing. But I enjoy teaching, you know. I work with adult farmers. It guarantees me an income every year. But I work with adults. I like working with young kids. And I like that to the point that I could farm and make a living at it, I believe. If I couldn't, I sure don't need to be teaching it. But at the same time, I get some rewards out of teaching that's over and above some of the rewards I receive from farming. And that's exactly why I teach.
Now, how many acres do you actually farm right now?
We're running 200 acres of row crops, corn, soybeans, and wheat. We double crop all of our wheat and beans, so about 300 acres of actual row crop that we go over a year, plus 32 acres of tobacco.
Okay, now this is primarily your own land, or is this rented?
I own 75 acres myself, and the rest of it's rented ground.
Okay, and your biggest crop is?
It's tobacco, as far as hours, dollars invested, and returns per unit produced. My biggest crop is tobacco.
Now, let's see, you come from the time period where, you know, we're both the same age. Don't want to make you sound like an old timer. You worked tobacco when there wasn't such things as pesticides, right?
Right. I worked tobacco when I was growing up. The average number of hours to produce an acre of tobacco was about 450 hours on dark fire cured tobacco. Today we have, by the use of chemicals and other, I guess you'd say, new techniques of handling the crop, we've cut that back to about 275 to 300 hours. Now that's productive, what we refer to as productive man work hours, hours that it takes to produce that tobacco and put it on the market. We do this primarily through the advent of chemicals and the use of new types of machinery. I can remember when I was a child, the tobacco was transplanted in the field, the plants were pulled off the plant beds and put in the field. They were transplanted where the man had a stick, or a peg, we call it. He made a hole in the ground, and he stuck the plant in, put the dirt back around the roots, and walked to the next one and put another one in. Today, we have an own machine that I can set. One man couldn't set an acre of tobacco back in a day's time. Today, I've got a machine that I can take about three hands, and we can set it for an acre of tobacco in the ground in an hour. They have machines you can do it in less than 30 minutes.
Huh.
Sucker control, where you're pulling the suckers off the crop. Used to, we start on Monday morning over about 4 acres, and this was a family of 8 of us. We start over 4 acres, and then we'd get on Friday at dinner, Saturday at dinner, and, you know, we'd hope to get on to Saturday at dinner. Today, I can take, we have a high bore sprayer, and in 10 minutes, I've got the suckers controlled from not just that week, but for the next 3 or 4 weeks until harvest by using chemicals. It takes me 10 minutes to do it. $15 or $20 worth of chemicals for that 1 acre. Whereas used to, it took, you know, a lot of hours of work to do it. Most of the harvest is still done by hand. Most of the market preparation is still done by hand. However, we are working with farmers in the community right now on some machines, trying out some harvesters, and trying out some strippers also.
For tobacco?
For tobacco, right.
Huh.
All of the dark fire-cured and dark air-cured tobacco in this part of the country used to be split. A knife was used and split right down the middle and hung on sticks. We've gone from that to a spike, a spear, so to speak, that we don't split that stalk. It's got some problems. We're changing the method that we're using in housing and curing that tobacco. Brother and I built 2 new barns out here 5 years ago to accommodate this spear tobacco. They have fans. We can control the temperature and the humidity in those barns to where we can cure that tobacco out. That's the problem with spear tobacco, is that the water can't get out of the stalk. And we've had to build some new barns to accommodate that. But
you can get it out of the field a lot faster.
Get it out of the field faster.
Yeah.
And most of, you know, I hire a lot of kids in this type of thing, and they don't, the old timers, they know how to split tobacco. But anybody probably 25 years of age on down's never split. You can't even, there's no one out there that you can hire to do it. Most of them spear. So that's what we have to do. We're forced to that because of the labor market more than anything else.
Last time I talked to you, Bob, you told me something that I never had heard before, and that was that some of the old timers looked all upon the use of using herbicide or pesticide with a lot of disdain. Would you kind of elaborate on what they thought about the neighbors using that?
If somebody come in here and sold you a chemical, they were scared of it. Farmers were scared of those chemicals. Most of the early chemicals were crude to start with. Very little was known about wetting agents and wetting systems and the way these chemicals were put together. We knew that we mixed them with water and sprayed them on there, and if the weather conditions were good, we got good results. But if it was bad, we didn't get any results. They were also quite expensive. But you couldn't tell farmers that you could spray something that looked like water on a plant of tobacco, and that would make them, and that'd pull the suckers. They didn't think in terms of chemical reactions. They thought most farmers at that time, in the mid-50s and 60s, and some of them even in the 70s, they thought in terms of that chemical, some way or another, had to reach out there and pull that sucker off that plant. And you were looked at as a young rebel, as a young fool, if you used some of those chemicals at times. You were ridiculed until they were proven wrong. You had to prove it to them.
Which they probably were.
Yeah, right.
Eventually.
Right, eventually, you know, they were proven wrong. We had a lot of crops destroyed too. You know, you had some farmers that'd stand on the fence row once again. They'd see somebody using chemicals, man, I'm gonna try that, and he'd go out and do it wrong, which added fuel to the fire of the ones that did ridicule you. You know, so and so else, somebody else tried it, and they completely demolished their crop. But there was a vast thing of education too. Farmers had to be educated as to the use of chemicals. Just like today, we're just beginning to begin education on computers for farmers. And you try to get a 50-year-old farmer, and that's about the average age of farmers in Graves County right now, is 53 years old, according to the survey that we ran last year. You try to educate a 53-year-old man and tell him that he needs something, a machine that he plugs into 110-volt outlet in his kitchen to help him run his farming operation, and he'll laugh at you. you know, just like they did when you tried to tell that farmer that there was a chemical that he could mix with water and spray on his crop and kill his tobacco suckers.
Just off the side, do you use a home computer in your operation?
I use a computer service. I don't have a home computer. I use a computer service through the Production Credit Association for a farm refugee.
I really see the advantage of that. I mean, I can see how that could really help you out. But
farm computers are something we're just getting into. I'm just getting into it. Within the next 5 years, I'm sure that I'll own one.
Okay, let me jump back again on this, the way the old timers felt about the changes. When I talked to you before, you said something about there's a social factor involved.
Oh, right. You were almost ridiculed and sarcasm, completely out of the picture, you know, almost shunned at times for things that you, if you tried something new. These guys, when chemicals and things like this, machinery too, first would come out. When chemicals came out in the 60s, you know, there was this thing of you put this mix of this oil, we call it oil, it was a fatty alcohol, but you mixed it with water and you put it in a detergent bottle and you packed 12 ounces in a detergent bottle and went from one plant to the next and squirted it down the stalk, and that hit there at the axle and burnt the bud out, the sucker bud out. The first year that I got involved in growing tobacco on a large scale, the second year out of college, the second year that I taught, we went from like 10 acres to 35 acres just overnight, 1 year. And we didn't afford, I'll give you, use this as an example, we couldn't afford to pay people and to do it ourselves, take the time to walk from one plant to the next with this 10-ounce squirt bottle and squirt this fatty alcohol water solution on every single plant. The number of hours per acre was prohibitive. I bought one of these high-bore sprayers. It was a large upright field sprayer that you can drive through tobacco crop with without breaking any leaves off. They're built like a tricycle, and they have a tendency, they're top-heavy. They have a tendency to fall over real easy with people on them. My brother and I developed a system of spray tips where we could apply this stuff with a machine. We start out with two rolls at a time, application. It would take approximately 45 minutes to do this. Now, one of the problems and the reason that you packed that by hand was that if you got any of that solution out on the leaf of that tobacco, it would burn a hole in it. So we had to come up with not only an apparatus that would get it to run down the stalk by driving through it rather than walking. We had to come up with a solution so weak that it would not burn the leaves, and yet it would go ahead and kill suckers. So it took some experimentation, quite a bit of it. When we came up with the idea and we tried it, and we got good results, we wrote the company that manufactured the fatty alcohols. The next year we set up some test plots for those people and got the backing of them, and now, because of this research and things that we've done, we have that system perfected. We didn't get a patent on it, we didn't do anything like that, but we now, in our custom spray service, we do this. Yeah. We have a lot of other farmers that do it.
So you have a custom spray service that you operate to?
Right. But now these farmers that first saw that laughed, they just hee-haw. And you know, you go to a restaurant, you took a lot of kidding about it. You can't do that, boy. You're going to ruin that crop without me. Yeah. Well, it didn't burn it up. I sure thought it would. But I'll tell you one thing. It'll be green when it goes to the barn. It won't never be ripe, you know. And you'd be laughed at Yeah, Rick, you know, they laugh you plumb out. You know, you setting up drinking coffee at the restaurant, they laugh you plumb out.
People think you're lazy for.
Well, yeah, they have. You know, they called you lazy. You're good for nothing. You know, you just too damn lazy to get out there and do it the way it ought to be done. You work harder getting out of work than you would at working, they'd say. You know. They really give you hell for trying to find a better way. I'm going to give you another example. I went to a field day about several years ago and saw F.W. Richter's, that's a large tobacco seed producing corporation in Kentucky, watched them sell some plant beds. And they sold a little cedar. Now, up until that time, everybody in this part of the country sold their plant beds by hand, and you couldn't sell them on windy days. And plant beds had to be sold in February and March in order to get the plants there by the middle of May and the 1st of June to set to ripe. And they'd take them and they'd mix these plants, or mix these seed with meal or wood ashes. And they'd take their hand and they'd sell them. And they'd walk around. Well, if the wind was blowing, tobacco seed are about the size of a pinhead, a little bit smaller than a pinhead. And if the wind's blowing, it'd blow them all to one side and you wouldn't have any seed on that bed. It'd just totally destroy them. And if you didn't have any plants come up, you know, you're losing trouble. And plant production was a lot of times hit or miss for a lot of farmers. I went and watched them, and they had just a small lawn fertilizer spreader, 3 foot wide, held 50 pounds of fertilizer. We would mix an eighth of an ounce of seed with 50 pounds of fertilizer. We'd put some herbicide right in next to those seed. Now, herbicide killed grass, but it won't. The type that we use, this particular chemical, would not harm a tobacco seed. But you can make them farmers believe that. And later on, make them believe that you could get these seeds through this dang little spreader, an eighth of an ounce mixed up in 50 pounds, and make it come out right. They thought all them seeds fall out in one place. You know. The first year, people stood in the damn road down there by my house and watched me do this and laughed. Every time I'd go to the store or restaurant until my plants come up, they laughed me out.
Is that right?
Hell, I couldn't go to the restaurant and eat lunch.
Well, they still do that mixing with meal and sort of by hand.
Yeah, I know
someone would do that.
Well, next year, I had one guy came to me, and he wouldn't come to me at the store.
Yeah.
He came to me at my house late one night, and he said, "That cedar I saw you use last year," I said, "yeah, it's a pretty good plant, son. I'd like to borrow that thing." Now, he wouldn't do it in public.
Yeah.
And he borrowed it and sold the damn plant beds after dark one night. I went over and helped him, but he didn't want anybody else to know it, but he had good beds. In the last 3 years, I can't keep my little cedar at home. And we're talking about a $30 investment, you know. But now we grow, most farmers will have 200 yards plant bed. I have 2,100 yards plant bed, because when we set to buy, we want to set all 30 acres in 1 week and be done with it. A lot of farmers, you know, set two or three times. But we have a lot of plant beds, and I had, you know, I've done that out of necessity. But farmers now are learning, and your plants are better. They're healthier. And they're more spread out all over your bed.
Seems like you'd have a more even distribution.
Right. But you couldn't make them believe it. Now, they laughed. You know, their fathers and their grandfathers and everybody before them had sold plant beds and mix it with wood ashes, mix the seed with wood ashes or flour or meal, and sold them, and that was the way it had to be done. You couldn't push that little spreader. And I noticed down here at the mill the other day, they had five or six of these little cedars out and said they'd already sold about a dozen and was expecting to run out of them. But anything new like that, farmers going to laugh at.
What about no-till? How did the farmers react to that?
Oh, my God, that was the biggest problem. No-till in Kentucky is native to Kentucky. People in Kentucky were the first ones. Christian County, that's the boys of Christian County that pioneered this thing. And we know more about no-tilling than anybody else in the country, the farmers in Kentucky. University of Kentucky got some grants from the federal government, and the main reason is we got a lot of hilly ground that we need to leave covered and not break up. So we got some grants and things. Well, if you don't remember, no-till farming's come about since the advent of so many chemicals, because we can use the chemicals for the weeds. Well, when no-till farming first come out, you had boys that are, and still today to some extent, you got guys that are good at it, and you've either got a good job or you have a disaster. It's no in-betweens hardly at all. And a lot of farmers did, you know, they argued and argued and argued that you couldn't do it, that there wasn't no way. That ground had to be broke up, it had to be worked down, and it had to be level. Everything had to go right, you know. And then it had to be cultivated. You got to plow that crop to make it, you know. You got to get that ground tore up and keep it loose all the way through. They just wouldn't believe it. Now we've got some older farmers that are trying it. You can't get them to do anything else. They see that the farmers look a lot of times at the short term instead of the long term. You know, they don't, they can't look down the road so far as holding a, you know, storage of grain. Farmers never did. They wouldn't store grain to wait and sell next year. They sold it right when they got it out of the field. We're beginning to see a change. Farmers are looking down the road more. Farmers buy a farm, they broke it up, they tilled it, they worked it. They didn't look down the road 10 years from now and say, hey, you know, breaking this ground every year and tearing it up, I'm going to lose all my topsoil. They're beginning to realize some of this for the first time. I attribute that a lot to education all the way across the country. They're beginning to be more alongside. We're in a time right now of rural farm problems. And today's farmer that you find out here, it doesn't matter who he is, he's aware, if he's in farming business, he's aware of what's going on all over the world.
Seems like it had to be.
You know, markets and changes in prices and things.
Would you say the changes in the last 12, 15 years have been the biggest period of change ever in farming history?
Okay, there's about three or four things that changed, of course, in farming history. The first thing was the Industrial Revolution. That changed it more than probably anything, machinery. Replacing hand labor and animal labor with machines. That was the biggest contribution probably. The second biggest contribution was the development of hybrids. We went from 10 bushel corn to 150 bushel corn, seems like overnight, that and fertilizer. We learned how to use fertilizers, something that farmers had to be educated once again about. Just like learning how to use that tractor, they had to learn how to use fertilizers and hybrid seed. You know, that farmer had always gone to the corn crib and shelled his corn and went back and planted that same stuff the next year as open pollinated. Okay, now we've got the hybrid seed. We don't grow our own seed much anymore except soybeans. Okay, so the advent of hybrid seed, the advent of fertilizers and chemicals. Today, the advent of on-the-farm marketing of products. Talking about farmers locking in hedges, hedging their prices and things, and being more aware, storing their grain, and waiting till market conditions get such that they can afford to sell. That and computers is the next two frontiers. Once again, you've got to take the farmers back to the classroom and teach them how to do it.
Would you say that they're getting more fluid or more flexible with all these changes and saying, well, maybe how Granddaddy how he did it is not really the best way now,
yes,
even though it was good then.
Right. And you have a different, you're turning over a different generation too. Now, like I said, the average age of the farmer is going down. In this community, it keeps going down every year. It used to be up in the 60s, and now it's dropped down to about 53 years of age. You got a lot of guys that are farming today that are our age, 30 years old, that have come up and they've seen all these changes as far as chemicals and seen the changes as far as what hybrids can do and high levels of fertilizer, no-till. Things like that.
Of course, by the time they get to be 60, they may get to be sticking
right.
in muds, too.
Right, they're going to be stagnated, too.
Yeah.
But Daddy always had a saying, don't ever be the first in the community to try something. But sure as hell don't be the last, because it'll cost you money to be the last. I experiment a lot. I set up test plots. I do that for my own self, but I also do it. I have farms out in the community, farmers, that do some experimentation for us too. And we, through adult classes, and not just here in this one school, all across Gage County, we have adult classes or education farmers, where they come in.
And now, do you teach those?
I teach some. I work with young farmers from ages 18 to about 30. We have an adult farm management consultant that teaches classes too. Your Production Credit Association, your Farm Bureau, they're all interested in and are backing up education programs of sorts. Education is the key, in my opinion, to being a good farmer. Rural mail carriers will tell you that. The rural mail carrier will tell you that he delivers more pounds of mails to the farmers on his route than he does any other one. And it's in the form of pamphlets and magazines and all types of farm publications. A farmer that will not come in every night and sit down and read two or three magazine articles, he's going to get behind pretty quick.
Do you have more leisure time now with all these changes? Seems like you still have to stay up on top of everything.
You got to stay up, but you got more leisure time too. You know,
of course, things are more complicated now than they were 25 years ago.
Decision today, a single decision today, you can talk about a $20, $50, $100,000 decision that you have to make, and you have to make on the spur of the moment. Whereas used to, a decision was a lot cheaper to make. Not only that, the ramifications of that decision was not as great. If you had to buy a tractor 30 years ago or 20 years ago, $300. Of course, that's a lot of money back then. But at the same time, it wasn't $90,000 like that combine is today. We traded a lot of our work, physical work, for mental work. And you read more today about stress in farmers. It's number one and number two in the nation, I believe, as far as stress-related problems.
That makes sense.
We traded a lot of that, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have as many farmers with broken backs and cut-off hands and things as you used to have. But you've got more probably that are seeing psychologists and psychiatrists, and suicide rates going up every day in farms.
Do you currently have livestock?
No, I don't have any livestock.
Nothing? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, considering the fact that you teach full-time, I mean, this is at least a 40-hour-a-week job, probably closer to 50 or 60,
yeah.
If it's like my high school teachers. Do you still consider yourself a full-time farmer or a part-time farmer?
I make the biggest part of my income from farming.
And so let me get this straight. You got an income from farming and also from working as a vocational ag teacher.
Right.
Your wife has an income from working at the bank. And then do you do some kind of a part-time spraying service or something?
We have a spray service. We operate a custom spray service for tobacco. We apply chemicals, herbicides, and insecticides of all types to tobacco.
Now this is you and your brother?
My brother and I. We also have an auction service, too.
Are you an auctioneer?
I'm a apprentice auctioneer. I don't know, have my license yet. But
you can do that kind of talk and get that rattle going there.
we do all these things. We stay busy.
Yeah, I bet you do.
But I enjoy working. It's my favorite thing to do, I guess.
Is it work?
It's work. I'd rather work than do anything else.
Well, is there a partnership? Is it just you and one brother, or is it other brother?
The farming operation, the tobacco, started out a few years ago, and the tobacco is a partnership. And also, it's been a partnership all these years on all the row crop. The equipment for the row crop operation has helped. In partnership agreement, the land is rented in a partnership agreement, and but we still own separate parcels of land also. But any land that's rented, we rent together. The tobacco was that way also for 2 or 3 years, but the tax advantages in the tobacco was such, and the business got so dadburn complicated that we were having to file. I was filing a return. He was filing a tax return. The partnership was filing a tax return. Uncle Sam was coming up more of the cake than we were. So we dissolved the partnership, actually, as far as a formal partnership. We dissolved that and now operate independently. The spray service is such that he owns the equipment, I do the work, and we split the profit. The auction service is such that we both got into it at the same time. I decided to go back to school, so I didn't go all the way with it the first couple of years. And now I'm back in school, but it is a 50-50 partnership. There's a lot more to getting an auction sale than just sitting up there and trying to bid. You know, you've got the materials have got to be lined up, and the sale has to be conducted according to law and all that, and you've got to have a license and everything to do that. And a lot of work. You know, if you have a household sale, all the stuff, you've been to auction before, all that stuff's got to be packed outside. If it rains, it's got to be packed back inside, you know.
Now, are you going to try to auction, be an auctioneer like on a, just like a tobacco auctioneer or just for the commodities and...
No, just a
general auction.
Auctioneer.
Yeah.
I don't want anything that's going to conflict with my school teaching. If I can have a personal household sale on a Saturday during the spring or a farm auction or something, I might do it. I went to auctioneer school. I trained some auctioneers here in high school. We had auctioneering contests. And that's sort of what got me interested in it.
I'd like to know how a person learns to talk like that. I can't imagine.
You know, you just,
like yodeling, you know. Yeah. I can't imagine how you just fall into it.
You just practice it. Yeah. You can count to 1 to 100. And if you can count from 100 to 1 backwards, you can learn it. You have to sit and listen to other people for a long time. And you have to get a rhythm down. But once you get a rhythm, then in practice, you can do it. Anybody can do it.
Maybe.
Well, not anybody. If you just tongue-tied physically or something.
Sometimes I have a radio program. I'm on the air every Saturday, 10 to 12, live on WKMS. And sometimes I wonder, I get a little tongue-tied.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
you don't have things to say, you know. Let's see. Now, are you available for any kind of consulting type service to the local farmers, or is that just on the cuff? You do get paid for that?
No, we don't get paid. That's just part of the responsibility of the local agriculture. You know, you may have I had a farmer last spring that called me on the 20th of June. He had a problem with the tobacco crop blooming out early.
Uh-huh.
You know, what do I do? And I make recommendations like this. You may have a woman that's got a green bean plant in her garden that some sort of a nematode's eating on, and she calls you, you know, and that's the most important thing to her that there is
and you go out
and it's eating my green beans, you know. And I'll go out and I'll take samples of it. We use University of Kentucky pathologists at Princeton experiment stations and things, both in livestock and crops, to get results back to the people real quick.
Well, let me ask you something. This just popped in my head. If you have you noticed since you've been using these pesticides, especially the insects or the worms or whatever have become acclimated to the pesticide and they're getting tougher? I mean, you see that sometimes with DDT, you know, with flies and mosquitoes and stuff.
They get immune to different types of things.
Same type, yeah.
What we, you know, like 1 year we'll use a chemical. We had a couple of commercial pesticides that we were using for a couple of years, and man, they would kill them and keep them killed for days. After about 3 years of use, I'm not sure, as far as the labels are concerned, the pesticide labels were the same as they were the first few years that they built a chemical and put it on the market. The labels and percentages of active ingredients and all are exactly the same. And formulations are the same, and we use it the same, but we don't get the same results. I believe they get immune to that stuff.
So the bugs are getting tougher.
Well, you know, it's a thing of, it's sort of like human beings, only the strong survive. And you get a strain of worm or larva or whatever that's resistant to a particular chemical, they're going to live through that spring, and those eggs are going to hatch. And you keep producing the strongest ones. So they're going to keep on getting tougher.
Do you have any, besides you and your brother and your wife, do you have any full-time hired help?
I have one full-time hired man.
He works year-round?
He works from Usually about the middle of April, about the time we start working corn ground, all the way through until about the middle of February. And then he's off a couple of months. But this tobacco business, we started tobacco crop in October. This year, my tobacco crops have started last October. I started preparing plant beds. I'll sow those beds in March of this year. I'll sell that tobacco. I started in 83, grow it in 84, and we'll sell it in 85. So one crop spans 3 years. The only time that I'm not involved on another day-to-day basis in that tobacco is from the middle of February until about the middle of April. And from there on, it's an everyday thing, something to do every day. And so I've got one boy that I hire full-time.
Let's see now, are you taking advantage of the pick program?
Yes, we last year had everyone we could get pick.
And do you think that was beneficial?
Oh, yes.
For you?
It done two things for me. It stopped me from having to use as much credit for a year. It gave me some income without any risk involved, you know.
That's true.
No risk whatsoever, just actually a gift in a sense. But at the same time, you know, all my equipment, just because I didn't put out a crop, the equipment charges did not stop. The depreciation on my equipment didn't stop. I had to control the weeds that was left on the field that came up voluntarily. We were out some money to sow that stuff down. To comply, you had to sow your crop land down. So we were out some money. It wasn't all free as such, but it got me, and you know, if we was going to have a dry year, thank God it was a year I didn't put out a crop or a big row crop. It was good. I think it's done, served its purpose. I'm not sure we don't need another year to it.
To bring the prices?
Surpluses.
So then you weren't really hurt by the 83 drought as much as some people?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. The boys that didn't go in to pick, it was catastrophic. They're the ones that's having the options this time, selling out.
Yeah, that's bad.
It's broken.
So you didn't lose anything? You didn't have a...
No, I made some money this year in the tobacco business. Didn't make as much as last year. I made some money in tobacco. Now, what little row crop I had, I lost.
I know I had a small garden that I have, and I had high hopes that last year, I think it was around July 4th or something like that. Just got out my second crop of corn. Everything was looking great. But that was the last rain we had.
And on corn and soybeans too, a lot of people don't realize that it's not only a lack of water,
it's a heat.
Temperature. We done some studies last year. We found in some 20 acre corn fields down here, which is a small field really, that those temperatures out there where there's no air stirring and there's so much radiant energy reflected back off those leaves and all, during some of those hot days, you get a 99 and 100, 101 degree temperature. You were getting 130, 131 degree temperatures out in the middle of cornfields, which was actually burning the silts off.
What about, I think it was during 1980, they had such a hard summer, the temperatures hovered around 110 for a week or two. Did you have crops out then?
Yeah.
And they got burnt up?
I was lucky. I had a lot of corn but it was in the bottoms along these little creeks.
Oh, so you had more moisture.
Had more moisture. We still pulled an 80. I still had 86 bushel corn yield, and we got a good price for corn that year. You were talking $4 corn, which made a big difference. And, you know, there's a whopping difference between $4 corn and 86 bushel and 10 bushel corn at $4. A really big difference.
Yeah. What do you see? We talked about this before, but let's see if we can get it on tape. What do you think about the future of the family farm versus the big corporate farms that we see cropping up everywhere?
Okay, the family farm is going to survive. That's been proven in your communist socialist bloc countries, you know, where they have resorted, especially in like Czechoslovakia and Romania and places, those socialist governments have resorted to giving the farm operator a parcel of land, an acre or 2 acres or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's been proven that they can grow twice to three times the amount of farm products
Just because it's there now?
Versus the community health or socialistly health grant, because it's theirs. You know, it's just like anything else. You know, if you were in the business of mowing yards and keeping lawns, yours would probably look prettier than anybody else's because it was yours. People just are going to do more for themselves than they are anybody else. And same way with farming. We've had the advent of the corporation farm. We've had two right here in our neighborhood. And they got into livestock businesses, both of them. And they had a situation where they made some money on some seed stock for exotic breeds of livestock. But once that those breeds were established, they got out. They couldn't make any money. The hired farm manager, if he's a damn good farm manager, he'll be managing his own farm. Now, don't get me wrong, we've got some good people managing farms. I don't mean that to slur some of the farm managers, right? But at the same time, in most instances, if a guy is good at it, he'll do it for himself.
So then do you see that the larger corporation farms are going to start to dwindle a little bit? Or?
Oh, yeah. When the tax advantages are structured such that there's no tax advantage to a corporation to get involved in farming, there will be no corporate farms.
Do you ever take an active role in state politics? Or?
Oh, yes. Both as an educator and as a farmer. Local politics I stay out of because I'm an employee of the school board.
Well, that's understandable, yeah.
But in state politics, as far as education and all is concerned, I've been past president of Kentucky Ag Teacher Association and different things. As far as farm groups and all, I try to take an active role in things like production credit associations. I'm not a member of Farm Bureau, but Tobacco Producers Association, things like this. I try to take an active part in.
Oh, one thing we didn't even mention, good grief, probably talk an hour on this alone is the FFA. You're had a big impact on your life as you were growing up in high school. Then you're the sponsor now in Sedalia.
As an advisor, came back, yeah.
And you told me last time I was here that something about some achievements that the boys have done here. Could you tell me, kind of recap that?
We've had some students. What we offer in FFA is leadership development. We teach, of course, agriculture for gainful employment, production agriculture. We try to get kids involved in farming or in an agribusiness situation. But we also teach a lot of cooperation, leadership development, public speaking, and things of this sort, farming procedure, and try to put out in the community and back on the farm not only a person that's trained well in farming and how to farm, but also a person that can be a community leader. We try to turn out a product of a student that didn't mind getting up before a group and taking charge. A good public speaker. He can conduct himself in a business meeting. He knows a little about parliamentary procedure and Robert's Rules of Order. He knows committee structure and committee design and can get things organized and get activities done. That helped me a lot. I was fortunate as an FFA officer here and on the regional level and was able to run for a state officer. I didn't get it. But I've had a couple of kids here that's been elected to state offices since I've been here. Out of about 15,000 members, I've had a state president and a state secretary. I've also had some kids with our farming programs that have competed on the national level. And we're in a tough one. Region, nationally, we're in the central region, of course, the Corn Belt states. We're in there with them. And crop production, livestock production, both when you're competing with people from Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, you've got a lot to compete in. But we offer a little bit more than just an agricultural club. It's a club that offers the kids a lot of leadership ability, too. And social recreation, you know, we have some things for rural recreation parties and things that, you know, some of your rural kids don't get a lot of organized recreational activities, and we develop some of those here.
Do you stress such things as diesel mechanics and all the things that you've talked to me about, knowing how to take care of a farm and manage equipment and stuff like that.
We got a saying and a motto in FFA of learning to do, doing to learn, earning to live, and living to serve. And I teach mechanics.
Don't ask me to repeat that. But
okay. I teach mechanics. I teach crop production, livestock production in the classroom. That's giving them something. They learn how to do it. But now you and I could talk all day long about changing an injector on a diesel engine. Or cleaning an injector on a diesel engine. But until you actually got out there in that shop and got your coveralls on or blue jeans on, got your hands greasy, and got in there and pulled that injector out and cleaned it or exchanged it, then you wouldn't know how to do it. So we provide them an opportunity to do things to learn to.
A lot of hands-on experience.
We have the supervised experience program. That's the farm enterprises that we talked about earlier. And they earn some money from the things that they've learned. And then we also have contests. I have all 40 different contests each year. And it ranges from a situation where a kid can grow the most corn profitably per acre, or a kid that can manage the biggest farming program, to public speaking and prostitute speaking, to chapter meeting contests and things like this. We also have competition to see who can be the best at some of the things that they learn. And this competition is on a local level. It's on a regional level. Here in Western Kentucky, we compete against each other from state and on to a national. We have an awards program for these on every level. The students are recognized for their achievements. There's money involved in it, cash awards. These are supported by agribusiness and other non-farm sections, that support these activities for us. But it gives the kids not only an opportunity to take what they learn and earn, but it also takes something for them to say, I'm good at something. I can do something. And I can accomplish something. I can win it. And it makes winners out of it. And when you graduate a winner, you graduated somebody more than just an educated person. You graduated a winner. And he's going to take that winning attitude and get out here and farm, or get out here and run a business, or go to the Army and serve with a winning attitude. I'd hell about rather have somebody in the Army serving my country and protecting me with a winning attitude than I had a negative attitude. I'd rather have a neighbor with a good attitude than I had a bad. So the FFA program, I think, is the best program that we have going for us in our schools, rural schools today. We've got a lot of people that have come behind the Future Farmers of America and copied it. We have the Vocational Industrial Clubs of America and the Future Business Leaders and the Home Economics Group and the Future Homemakers and all these people. But the FFA was the first one, and they've been the leader in it.
How many hours do you figure you put into all your activities at school, including being in school plus stuff off the clock, but still school-oriented?
The first year I figured it up, I taught at Lowe's. Of course, I drove down about a 40-minute drive each way, but I figured I made about $2 an hour. I worked a lot of hours. In the spring of the year, when all of our contests, our projects are over and our record books, each student keeps a record book and his book summarized and he knows what he's done, we start having our local contest and getting ready for a regional contest.
Right.
From January until April, we'll give you an idea. I haven't been home a normal night in about the last 3 weeks.
So, you get in late, you're saying 12 or 1 o'clock or something?
Yeah, I got in early last night. We had a practice and we went from school starts at 8 o'clock. Well, from 3 o'clock till 6 o'clock last night, I was working with the chapter meeting team up here. I worked with them Monday night, today is Tuesday, and Monday night I worked with them from 6:30 until 11 o'clock. On the same thing. Today's Wednesday, and this is church night, so we won't work tonight. Now I'll have some paperwork reports to get out this afternoon, but I'll go home and eat supper at normal time tonight. And a lot of kids go to church on Wednesday night. But tomorrow night we've got it scheduled already from 6:30 to 9:30 chapter meeting. I also have an adult class being conducted here by our adult farmer management consultant that starts at 7, and those guys won't quit till probably 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'll have to be down here till they quit. So yeah, you work 16-18 hours a day during January.
Yeah, I would worry about teacher burnout under the circumstance.
Well, we don't have a lot of old white teachers. We don't have very many old. Stay with it. It's a young man's game. Or a young woman's game. We have a few women white teachers.
To kind of wrap it up, what do you see as your personal future in teaching and on the farm?
If I didn't think there was a future in it, I sure couldn't stand up here before these little fellas and tell them every day that
there is.
That there is. There is a future. As long as there's people on the face of this earth, they've got to have something to eat. And as long as they've got to have something to eat, somebody's got to grow it for them. Because we don't have the land for everybody to come out of the cities and grow their own. They don't have the technology and the know-how to do it to start with. So it's going to be left up to a very few of us to produce the food and fiber for this whole world. And as long as that situation exists, and as long as there's that many people, then it'll be left up to a few to produce it. And if we're going to continue to be a moral country, a moral society, then I'm going to do all I can as a farmer to grow as much as I can, because I don't mind sleeping with a $500,000 debt every night. I can live with that. But knowing that there's a kid in Cambodia starving to death gets next to me. Whenever I've got acres out here idle. And I honestly believe that just about every farmer feels that way.
What do you think about the use of grain then as a weapon? Like the grain embargoes.
I'd much rather see them use have you ever seen an animal in a laboratory starve to death?
I've seen them out on the sides of the road. I've seen old cur dogs.
I'd much rather take a bullet and kill them than I had starve them to death, or a bomb and blow them up. If I'm going to have to choose my way, I'm saying that because of the way I want to die. I want to go quick. I'm not real fat, and I wouldn't last very long if I starved to death, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to see my little boy or my wife want to starve to death before my eyes. I'd much rather all three of us be killed in a bomb explosion, whether it be a nuclear bomb or whatever. But I think it's wrong. Killing people is wrong, but letting them starve to death is worse than killing them with a damn bomb, in my opinion. And this food for weapon thing's already, it's hurting. So that's what's got farming in such problems.
Well, it didn't work. Apparently they got their grain from other sources.
We sold that grain to Canada. Canada turned right around and shipped that stuff run it through a pipeline. They had to hold it for 60 days in storage, but then they could sell it to Russia at a profit. It made a lot of Canadians rich. We sold it to France, and France turned around and sold it to Russia. We sold it to a lot of Scandinavian countries, and they sold it to them. It was all black market. You can go to Russia today, and you can find that grain with the U.S., if it's in some of these commodities, and wouldn't just grain with those commodities too, they have the U.S. stamps on it. It's sitting there, and they're using it, but the only thing was it went through off carrier, it went through Canada or whatever. And everything's kept quiet.
Do you ever worry about the farmer's image to the public in terms of PR, like you had the grain embargo thing, and that hurt the farmers, and I think that set them back. And you had the farmers, the big march on Washington with the combines going down Pennsylvania Avenue, and I think the pig program has been controversial. Do you worry about how the public views a farmer?
Well, consumer education is another thing that you've got to do. whoever that housewife is, she don't understand if she goes into the market one day and pork chops are 89 cents a pound, and the next day she goes in at $1.15. She thinks that the difference between 89 cents and $1.15, which is 26 cents, that 26 cents, her thing is, farmer probably got that. She doesn't realize that simply because Japan came over here last week and bought 10 million metric tons of soybeans and corn, and corn prices went up here, and a hog farmer has to buy corn and compete with people like Japan, or Japan swapped a bunch of Toyotas and Hondas for the damn corn, that this Joe hog farmer out here has got to compete with Japan and their dollar to buy corn, feed the hogs, and we put the stuff on the table to start with. And the middleman too. Consumer education is key. And I said it before, and I'll say it again. The farmer is never going to get rich. He's going to make a decent living, most of the time. And we've had some boys that's cleaned up the damn grain market. You know, they cleaned up as speculators. Most of them. They didn't clean up their own stuff. They cleaned up as speculators. You see farmers, you know, they do without all their life. I got students that's graduated last year and year before last. I got some that are driving new cars. They're going to college and having the time of their life. I've got others that are out here trying to buy a farm that are driving old cars and old pickup trucks, taking every dollar they can get to stick back to farming operation. So farmers starve to death most of their life. And then when they do get this land stuff paid for and they retire, they are considered to be rich. But they paid their dues back down the line somewhere. If they're paying for $1,000 acre land, they're doing about something that other people are doing. And they haven't got that 2-week paid vacation all their life too. You know, it's a set of values. As far as getting rich, you know, rich or beauty or whatever is in the eye of the beholder. So, consumer education is key.
And so for your own future then, if you burn out as a teacher, you may go into administration or retire to the farm or jump off a bridge.
If I burn out as a teacher, I don't feel like I could be an effective administrator if I couldn't be an effective teacher. So I'll probably go back to the farm.
Yeah.
That's my first love.
Well, can you think of anything that we haven't touched on that maybe needs to be brought out or maybe something elaborated on fuller or anything like that?
It's just that farming is changing daily. Farmers and the public, general public too, must be educated to solve the problem. And farm problems are not something that's come up overnight because of an embargo or something like that. Farm problems we've always had a damn farm problem, you know. When farmers composed 90% of our population, they elected presidents and got things done. Now we're only 4% of the population and we don't count as much as we used to. But at the same time, maybe we don't have to count.
Of course, there's a lot of people in agribusinesses
part of that sector also.
Yeah.
It's a two-way street. It's a two-way street. Yeah. Education is key, I think.
Well, that's always true about anything. Well, let's wrap it up then.
Okay.
Good talking to you, and I appreciate the second chance to get out here and put this stuff on tape.
I appreciate it.